Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Try me.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. Today we're still in 1958, when James Brown there, who you may think of as the king of funk and soul in the 1960s, was already on the scene, but singing doo-wop. In 1958 in music also saw the modern version of a song called We Shall Overcome.
We shall overcome,
my Lord.
We shall overcome.
Not many better versions of that song than this a cappella one by the Freedom Singers from Albany, Georgia. Part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, singing it that way in April of 1960. And a member of the group, Bernice Johnson, looked back years later on NPR to the lyrics coming together into the modern version.
I remember when the organizers came to Albany, and I was singing I'll Overcome, and I was stopped by Cordell, who says it's not I'll, it's we. And he had gotten this lesson from Highlander and from Guy. And I looked at him, and you know, we've been singing this song all of our lives, and here's this guy who just learned the song, and he's telling us how to sing it. And you know what I said to myself? If you need it, you got it. What that statement does for me is document the presence of black and white people in this country fighting against injustice, and you have black people accepting that need because they were also accepting that support and that help.
Bernice Johnson, looking back to her days as one of the Freedom Singers in Albany, Georgia, part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And there was, of course, plenty to overcome. In 1958, 44% of whites said they would move if a black family became their next-door neighbor. Today, that figure is only 1%, according to Brookings. Maybe a lot of people aren't telling the truth, but no doubt it is still way down from 1958. And only 4% of Americans approved of black-white intermarriage in 1958, 4%, according to Gallup. In the summer of 1958, 24 young people from the Wichita Branch NAACP Youth Council staged what would become the first successful student-led sit-in of the civil rights movement. By August 11, 1958, according to the Wichita PBS affiliate, they had desegregated the Dockham drugstore lunch counter and all Rexall drugstores throughout the state of Kansas, and the movement gained a powerful new weapon in the fight for equal accommodations. And sometimes they sang this song called Leave Segregation Alone.
Alone, because they love segregation like a hound dog love a bone. A bone. Well, I went down to the dime store to get myself some eat. Well, they put me in the jail. When I said in them folks' seats, you better leave segregation alone, because they love segregation like a hound dog love a bone.
A version there by the Nashville Quartet, we think from a student sit-in in 1960. In 1958, the population of the United States was 174 million. Today, we're approaching twice that much at 325. The average age of the population went down a few months from 1948 to 1958 because the baby boom, the median age was just under 30. Today, it's just under 40. Like in 1948, African Americans still made up 10% of the national population. The Latino population edged up from 2% to 3%. But listen to this. The percentage of the population who were immigrants was about 8% in 1948. It went down to under 6% in 1958. That could be because of decades of restrictive immigration laws continuing to have their desired effect. There was also a deportation campaign in the mid-50s called Operation Wetback, which reduced the number of Mexican migrant farm workers who had been welcomed when there was a labor shortage during World War II. The percentage of men who were college graduates had gone up 3 points since 1948, from about 7% to about 10%. The numbers for women lagged behind, going from 7%, they were about even in 48, to only about 8% who had bachelor's degrees in 58. Interesting, that disparity. That might have also had something to do with the post-war period. Interesting that today, more women than men graduate college. The federal poverty rate was first measured in 1959. And according to Pew, it was a whopping 24%. A quarter of the population lived officially in poverty. And it varied wildly from state to state. The poverty rate in Mississippi was over 50%, which also gives an indication of how unevenly poverty was distributed by race. Mississippi is still the poorest state, but the rate is down close to 20%. How to measure poverty and what to do about it is a big culture war issue and has been for a long time. The Academy Award for Best Picture in 1958 went to Bridge Over the River Kwai. The country was still processing World War II. And so was the Nobel Committee. The Peace Prize went to Dominic Pier. I don't know if I'm saying P-I-R-E right, but Dominic Pier, a Catholic friar from Belgium, for his work resettling refugees after the war. The best-selling nonfiction book during this week in 1958 was Masters of Deceit, What the Communist Bosses Are Doing Now to Bring America to Its Knees, by the FBI director J. Edgar Hoover, with a strong suggestion of Russian influence on the American left. The New York Times nonfiction bestseller today, by the way, is A Higher Loyalty by former FBI director James Comey, which suggests Russian influence on the American right. Martin Luther King published his first book in 1958, Stride Toward Freedom, The Montgomery Story. And if you think of 1968 as the year Martin Luther King was assassinated, it was in 58 that someone else tried to kill him and came close. He was stabbed right here in Manhattan at a public appearance, signing autographs on copies of that book, when someone came up and stabbed him.
I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died.
Martin Luther King, looking back, ironically, on the night before he was successfully assassinated 10 years later. You probably know that Brown versus Board of Education, the school desegregation ruling, came from the Supreme Court in 1954. What you may not know is that Thurgood Marshall, an NAACP lawyer who argued Brown before he was named a Supreme Court justice, had to go back to the court in 58 to argue that the ruling actually applied to the states. Little Rock, Arkansas schools in particular were holding out. Here's 30 seconds of Thurgood Marshall in 1958 making a very avant-garde argument for those days that segregation was bad for white people.
And therefore, I'm not worried about the Negro children at this stage. I don't believe they're in this case as such. I worry about the white children in Little Rock who are told, as young people, that the way to get your rights is to violate the law and defy the lawful authorities. I'm worried about their future. I don't worry about those Negro kids' future. They've been struggling with democracy long enough. They know about it.
Thurgood Marshall in 1958. But he didn't convince the white mobs in Little Rock. And when I say mobs, it's not just a pejorative. When the school year started in September 57, President Eisenhower had to send U.S. troops, the U.S. military, into Little Rock to put down the violence that had broken out as resistance to integrating the schools. Here are the first 2 minutes of Eisenhower's legendary announcement, and hardly any of you have ever heard this before, I'm sure, on September 24th, 1957.
To make this talk, I have come to the President's office in the White House. I could have spoken from Rhode Island, or where I have been staying recently, but I felt that, in speaking from the House of Lincoln, of Jackson, and of Wilson, my words would better convey both the sadness I feel in the action I was compelled today to make, and the firmness with which I intend to pursue this course until the orders of the federal court at Little Rock can be executed without unlawful interference. In that city, under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. Local authorities have not eliminated that violent opposition. And under the law, I yesterday issued a proclamation calling upon the mob to disperse. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock, obviously for the purpose of again preventing the carrying out of the court's order relating to the admission of Negro children to that school. Whenever normal agencies prove inadequate to the task, and it becomes necessary for the executive branch of the federal government to use its powers and authority to uphold federal courts, the President's responsibility is inescapable. In accordance with that responsibility, I have today issued an executive order.
President Eisenhower on September 24th, 1957. Also that year, Eisenhower created the United States Commission for Civil Rights, and my next guest served on that commission for 24 years. Dr. Mary Frances Berry was a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights from 1980 to 2004 and served as chair from 1993 to 2004. In the Carter administrations, she was Assistant Secretary for Education in the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, as it was known then. Now she teaches history at the University of Pennsylvania, and she has a new book called History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. Dr. Berry, we're honored to have you as part of our series, The Eights. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you, Brian. After listening to what you said, which reminded me of the period, I thought, boy, I don't have anything else to say.
I think you have.
That was great. That was really great.
Thank you so much. And I think you have a lot else to say because you're in that period and part of the book. So relevant to the Eisenhower clip we just heard, you write about the first national event for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Dr. King's main group, in 57, a march on Washington with its main focus, the violent resistance that was taking place against Brown, the desegregation ruling. Can you tell us a little bit of that history, like how the SCLC came to be, or why the Supreme Court's Brown decision wasn't just accepted as settled law?
Well, I was in Nashville, Tennessee, going to high school when Brown was decided a segregated high school, of course, and walked down the street on the day that it was decided and saw the headline and said to my high school teacher who was with me, we were going shopping for something for the class graduation, and I said, oh, does that mean that the children will all go to school together next year, Ms. Hawkins? And she said, not so fast, Mary Frances, not so fast. And she was right. So that is a memory for me that is indelible. Also, we had had, of course, the Montgomery bus boycott, which Rosa Parks, after a number of people had sat down on buses and nothing had transpired, kicked off the Southern Montgomery movement with boycotts, which were eventually successful. The Brown decision was not implemented, but the fact that it existed meant that the lawsuit that was filed by the people in Montgomery won in the Supreme Court because it said that segregation had to end and their boycott was successful. So you had that happening. Also, SCLC was formed by the ministers after the boycott, and Martin Luther King was selected to lead the whole thing. And the prayer pilgrimage, which you mentioned in 1957 in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. was his coming out party. It was the first time Martin had made a speech at a national meeting. It was a huge meeting. And what he talked about was the need for the right to vote. He said, give us the ballot and we won't have to ask for anything else, because if you give us the ballot, then indeed the officials will be responsive to us. Well, he wasn't exactly right, but it was an important milestone. And that's when he came out as the leader and everyone acknowledged him as the leader. Now, Eisenhower had to deal with the aftermath of these domestic incidents as well as international affairs. This was a period in which African countries became independent, Ghana first, and others got their independence, and they sent representatives to the United States right there in New York to the United Nations. And they set up embassies in Washington, and they went back and forth by automobile between the two. And they were segregated and left out of restaurants and other public places along the highway, and there were all kinds of protests, and the Ghanaian ambassador was embarrassed, and Eisenhower invited him to lunch to try to make up for it. And at the meeting of his cabinet, President Eisenhower agreed to set up a civil rights commission and to ask for a Voting Rights Act in 57, and to work for that in the Congress, and that the commission would have subpoena power in order, as he said, to put the facts on top of the table about all these events and to make recommendations that might help to solve the problem. So it was international events as well as domestic events. And the commission was established after a hard fight by the segregationists in the Congress. And he worked in 1958, Eisenhower did, to appoint people to it and get them through the Senate, while Strom Thurmond, the senator from South Carolina, filibustered all the time. And the commission got set up, and its first hearing was in Alabama, where some of the commissioners were threatened. One had, the woman commissioner, had someone try to get in her room. I mean, it was terrible. But this was a landmark in the history of civil rights.
Listeners, we want to continue in this segment with listeners' oral history elements of our series, The Eights. For today, who listening right now was involved in the civil rights movement in 1958 in any way? We would love to hear a little bit of your story. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Call and tell us a story about your involvement back then. How is it different from racial justice activism today? 212-433-9692. Listeners, how do you remember the backlash in those days? Or maybe on the other side of the fence, you yourself or people you knew were part of that backlash. Did you or did they change over time? Or could the seeds of the modern culture wars be seen even then? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Listeners, we invite you to contribute some oral history, as we've been doing every day in the series so far. Today, your story of being involved in the civil rights movement or the backlash to it in or around 1958. 212-433-WNYC. And let's stay in the late 50s with this for today. We'll do all kinds of things about the 60s next week. But today, in or around 1958 in the 50s, 212-433-9692 as we continue with Mary Frances Berry. And when we come back here,
can I say, Brian,
please,
can I just say my own personal recollections as I guess I was 17. I was in the bus station in Huntsville, Alabama, passing through there. I was after high school, I was out doing a road trip, as it were, and went to the segregated window where the blacks had to go to buy food while the bus stopped. And there were police there and state troopers and everybody. And they said, you can't come in here, you know, just get back on the bus. And so we said, well, what's wrong? And they said, using the N-word, that N-word woman is trying to get in the University of Alabama, and she's not going to get in there, and we're going to stop her because we got police out all over the state, and she won't get her black into that school. So get back on the bus. And we did, and that was Vivian Malone, who is a relative of Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of Obama, who in fact was trying to get in the University of Alabama, and they'd called out troops and done everything else to stop her from doing it, a personal experience. And a second one is that my little brother, when they started sit-ins in Nashville, was in elementary school, and he marched the whole class out with him in front of them down to join the movement, as children did everywhere, despite the fact that the teachers kept yelling at them, come back here, come back here. They just kept on going.
Very vivid, and it's not every day we get to hear Mary Frances Berry talk about being 17. So when when we come back from a break, I want to ask how you think history should remember Eisenhower as a civil rights president compared to the presidents around him, Truman, Kennedy, and LBJ. So listeners, stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we continue with our series, The Eights, a brief history of the American culture wars, decade by decade. We are in 1958, and our guest is Mary Frances Berry, the longtime member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights, among other things. And her new book is called History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. So, Dr. Berry, how should history remember Eisenhower as a civil rights president?
Eisenhower was pretty good. He would, what today we'd call him, say, a moderate Republican, if there are any left around today. And there were a lot of black people who voted for Eisenhower. I remember some of the high school teachers saying, we're going to vote for him even though he's a Republican because, you know, it's about time we change parties. We keep having, you know, Democrats. And he seems like a reasonable person, has been a successful general and so on. And he was very good on the Little Rock crisis, although some people said he only took action because he hated anybody trying to oppose authority since he had been a general and a military guy. The implementation of the desegregation of the armed forces that had started, of course, earlier kept going smoothly during his watch. And Herbert Brownell, who was his attorney general and who was from New York, was one of the great civil rights attorney generals. He was the one who advised Eisenhower that he needed to put subpoena power in the law for the Civil Rights Commission so they could order people to testify, in part to give cover to victims who wanted to come and were scared, and to make others come. And Eisenhower, that's when he slammed the table and said, let's get the facts on top of the table. Let's do it. And Brownell and his Justice Department tried to enforce the civil rights laws that were on the books, even though the Voting Rights Act they got passed in 57 was fairly weak and we needed another one later on, they did a yeoman job given the times of working on. So I think he was pretty good.
Thomas in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thomas, thanks so much for calling.
Okay, you're welcome. I just wanted to add to the conversation. I was 10 years old in 1956. And Eisenhower was running for president. And I grew up on 334 Blake Avenue in Brownsville. Mm-hmm. And I remember on a Sunday afternoon, we had to go up, and we waited about an hour or so, and his motorcade came down Sutter Avenue between Rockaway, at that time Stone Avenue, which is now Mother Gaskin. So I just wanted to add to the conversation you hear about Brownsville today, negative, but in those days, Brownsville had a positive reputation, and I, 72 years old now, haven't been handcuffed or arrested in my life, but yet, I just want to add to the conversation that Brownsville has a positive side in my history.
Thank you so much for that, Thomas. Joyce in Lawrenceville, you're on WNYC. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I'm very interested in this conversation. I'm just enjoying it. I don't want to brag, but I was I'm lower than you, the person who just spoke. So I was almost 10 about the time that we're talking about, 58.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
and and I'm from Arkansas. So I lived in Arkansas, and some of my friends later helped to desegregate Little Rock. They just got all the black people, black kids whose parents would allow them to go, and that's how they did that. About this time, Martin Luther King decided to come to Pine Bluff, to my town, and I had been following him, reading all about him, and was really excited about seeing him. And my mother she was behind the times. The black community was segregated pretty much in that, thinking about the differences between SNCC and Martin Luther King, about taking it slow with regard to desegregation and just going with participating in the marches and everything.
And Joyce, did you tell our screener that your mother wouldn't let you go see Martin Luther King at your church?
So she wouldn't let me go, and I was really, really upset. So when I went to the mailbox the next day, which was on the one paved street in our community, where the quote, the street that the whites used to get through the black neighborhood, that's why I thought it was paved. I decided to lay down in the street and make the cars go around me. Don't ask me why. I was just always an obstinate child, and I just decided that's what I would do.
I'm one girl sit-in. Joyce, thank you so much for that wonderful memory and collection of memories. Dr. Berry, any reaction to the first two callers? And in particular, Joyce raised the issue of the pace that people would push for desegregation and differences within the activist community about that pace, yes?
Well, I think that some people were afraid to do anything. I remember in Nashville when my mother was asked by a reporter what she thought about school desegregation, and they put the story on the front page. She was just walking down the street, and she said, well, I don't think Negroes should go where they're not wanted. Yeah. So when she came home, she told us that, and the relatives, that she had said that, and she said it because she was scared. That's why she said it. It didn't have anything to do with how she actually felt. And some of the older people didn't think change would ever come. They didn't understand that protest is an essential ingredient of politics and that you have to take risks, which is what I write about in my book. You have to take risks. And they were worried about what would happen to the younger people. Even, you know, with the Montgomery bus boycott, there were some people who were not willing to, they didn't try to interrupt it, but they were scared. So you had different younger people, though, and children everywhere were anxious to come out and be activists.
Now, this series is on the evolution of the American culture wars, so we're looking at both progress towards social justice and the backlash to it. Here's an example of the backlash from that era. 1958 was the year that the ultra-conservative John Birch Society was formed. Here's the founder, Robert Welch, opening the door to labeling any movement he didn't like as communist-inspired or communist-infiltrated.
Our immediate and most urgent anxiety, of course, is the threat of the communist conspiracy, and well, it should be. For both internationally and within the United States, the communists are much further advanced and more deeply entrenched than is realized by even most of the serious students of the danger among the anti-communists. Almost every day, I run into some whole new area where the communists have been penetrating and working quietly for years. Until now, they are in virtual control of everything that is done in that slice or corner of our national life.
The founder of the John Birch Society, Robert Welch, in 1958. And Dr. Berry, you write in your book that the marches of that era were carefully patriotic to avoid red baiting by opponents of civil rights. So can you put the one in the context of the other?
Yes, indeed, because the Klan raised the banner of racism and communism, that all the black folks were doing, and outside agitators who were communists were making them do whatever they were doing, and the John Birch Society raised this banner, and the politicians in the Congress, there were a lot of Southern segregationists in the Congress of the United States, would in their rhetoric raise this. So every time there was a march or something, there would be out front these symbols of patriotism, and people would speak of patriotism, and people would describe what it is they were, the activists, what they were trying to do in terms of just implementing what the American creed required, not anything that's foreign or comes from any kind of other country. And because, in fact, the FBI harassed activists, we know that now, the history of it, and in fact tried to disrupt the movement. And the whole argument that they gave to successive presidents, that these were a bunch of communists who were trying to do this. So this was very important. The other thing is that not just the Birch Society, but the Klan, you said that there was backlash. Yes, there were bombings even, not just rhetorical backlash. A bombing of Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth's church down in Birmingham when the Birmingham people were first trying to engage in boycotts and sit-ins and voting protests. Luckily, nobody was in the church, so nobody was killed. It's not like the bombings we know about later. But using violence was something that the Klan did very often.
One more call. Marsha in Poughkeepsie, you're on WNYC. Marsha, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for taking me. I think this must have happened closer to 48 than 58. We had just moved to Topeka. My father was a psychologist. Our neighbors were a black psychiatric, a black psychiatrist, his wife and kids. And when September came, I got on a big yellow bus and went to a big brick school in town. And my neighbor's kids were picked up by a farm truck and taken to a little wooden school that was quite inadequate outside of town. And my mother flipped out. She got organized, as usual, and she began what became the 1948 decision and in Topeka. And I believe that she and my father stayed involved with it straight through until it was determined, because Dr. Clark, the psychologist who did the presentation to the Supreme Court, came to my father's funeral.
Mm. Marsha, thank you very much.
That's amazing.
For that memory. I'm sorry to say that we're out of time. We could do this for days, but we will continue for weeks on other years in our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the American Culture Wars, Decade by Decade. We finish now with 1958, and we move on to 1968 next week on Monday. And I want to thank our very special guest for today, Mary Frances Berry, whose new book is History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. Thank you so much. You're an inspiration.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
And as we go out, during his days as a civil rights organizer, Andrew Young, who went on to be mayor of Atlanta, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and a congressman, said that Nina Simone's music was the soundtrack of the movement. He said, every home I went to had Nina Simone. I mean, everyone. For all the people in the civil rights movement, it was an identity, unquote. And so we go out with a little bit of Nina Simone from her first album released in 1958. Here's Little Girl Blue.
Sit there. It's time you knew.
that fallen little girl.